corn is still king in Iowa, but the number of organic farms in the state is growing. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 3 weeks, Iowa State University will host its 10th annual organic conference. Kathleen Dellett of Iowa State University Extension will be here today to talk about the growth of the organic movement, how farmers can transition from conventional to organic, the role of organic grains, fruits, and vegetables in the local food system, and raising organic livestock. Linda Barnes is the coordinator of the Sustainable and Entrepreneurial Agriculture Program at Marshalltown Community College. We'll talk about teaching new farmers how to make a living growing organic. And finally, author Jean Logsdon will be here to tell us how we can manage manure to save mankind. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we're going to talk about manure. What's old is new again in the world of fertilizer. But first, conventionally grown corn, soybeans, cows, and pigs still dominate the agricultural landscape in Iowa, but organic produce and livestock farms are steadily growing in number. In about 3 weeks, Iowa State University will host its 10th annual organic conference. Kathleen Dellett is a professor of agronomy and horticulture and extension organic specialist at Iowa State University and one of the organizers of the conference. Kathleen, thank you so much for coming back again.
Thank you, Charity. Good to be here.
Also here with us today is Linda Barnes. She's coordinator of the Sustainable and Entrepreneurial Agriculture Program at Marshalltown Community College. Hello, Linda.
Good morning, Charity.
Thanks for being here today.
Sure.
Kathleen, I want to start with you. The world market for organic products reached $35 billion in last year, in 2009, and the demand continues to exceed the supply. But let's talk about here in Iowa. How significant is the organic and sustainable farming movement in Iowa?
It's actually pretty large and growing. I have the statistics for organic since they are recorded by the USDA. Sustainable, there's a lot of different definitions of it, so
right.
They don't have official numbers on it. But in organic, we have about 106,000 acres in Iowa, and USDA has us listed at 518 as the official certified organic, and then there's people suspect there's probably about another 150 that are practicing organic techniques without being certified organic. So we are the fourth largest number of organic farmers in the United States, and hopefully it'll keep growing. I think it will.
This is the 10th annual conference for Iowa State University, and I remember before I left the state of Iowa, I remember this organic movement growing and the idea of sustainable agriculture. We'll talk about some of the differences in a few minutes, really beginning to take hold before I left the state about a decade ago. But can you tell me how has the growth been over that 10-year period?
Right, yeah. When I came 12 years ago, there were about 29,000 acres, so you can see how much it went from 29 to 106,000 today. And just the support overall has been very significant. Actually, we always had good support from the state of Iowa. They were one of the first that came up with their own certified organic rules, and under Terry Branstad, actually, and then continued under Chuck Culver to increase the organic program at the state level by about, I think, 300%, and then as far as employees. And then at Iowa State, there's been a lot more support, but particularly at the federal level, there's been, in the Obama administration, there's been increasing amounts of grant dollars given for organic research and extension education, and that's really helped, I think, propel the industry and support for it.
This may not be something there are numbers on, but you probably have a feel for it. With this growth, 29,000 to 106,000 acres in the last 12 years or so, can you tell me how much of that has been farmers who had been farming conventionally transitioning into organic, and how much of that is new farmers starting to farm in an organic way?
Right. Actually, for Iowa's, it's typical of the state, the majority were conventional corn and bean farmers that probably had somewhat alternative operations to begin with, i.e. were growing a third crop like oats or wheat or something like that, and then made the transition all the way to organic. But no, the majority have been conventional farmers. Now, we do have an increase in new farmers coming in, too. Maybe Linda has more of a handle on that. So that's been really exciting. Across the nation, there's been a tremendous growth in new farmers coming into organic.
Well, and Linda, that's a great cue for you. You do spend a lot of time training new organic farmers. How long has your program at Marshalltown Community College been around?
Our degree program, if my memory serves me, started in about 2003. That's a two-year degree in entrepreneurial and diversified agriculture. And our farm, which is an organic farm, became student-ready in 2008. So we're building both together. And these students are really new to farming. I don't know that I've had very many at all that were in conventional farming and were looking to transition. So they tend to be students who've never farmed before.
When someone comes to you and they start this degree program, what do you teach them?
Well, I teach them the biology of farming, which I think is key to good sustainable farming when we understand how systems work. Students learn about soil science and then entrepreneurship and accounting, trying to start their own businesses. Because if you're a small farmer, the systems aren't set up like they are for conventional farmers to help move products. So our students have to be very good at business and very good at farming. So we teach them how to integrate those in their own operations, and then we give them experience with internships, typically in the summer, and they go out to a farm doing something they want to get into and give it a try to practice it.
And what do you do on the student organic farm?
On the student organic farm, it's about 100 acres, and it's certified organic. It includes some row crops, some open pollinated corn, and some corn that's white corn used for tortillas. We have some of it in hay, and then some of it is used in vegetable production for farmers market sales. And we also have a small hoop house that we're using to extend the growing season.
You mentioned white corn used in tortillas, so that that invites another question about who comes to you. I know that there are many people who have immigrated to the United States who are trying to get a foothold in agriculture. Do you find that you have a lot of students who are immigrants?
We have a lot of students in our non-credit program that are immigrants, particularly Hispanic students. We offered, in the last 2 years, a non-credit course that met Sunday afternoons for 3 hours, and it was taught in Spanish and English, and it was a Start Your Own Market Farm class. And when students completed this class, they have a business plan, and then they are welcome to use the farm to start their farm business. So we have some Hispanic students that are now on the farm doing that. And, yeah, some of them raise that white corn for tortillas, and they do sell at farmers market in Des Moines and direct market as well. So, yeah, we have a variety of students. One thing we're trying to do with this farm is we consider it an incubator farm, and students who come out, they cash rent the land the first year for 25% of the going cash rent rate. The next year it's 50%, the third year is 75%, and the fourth year they pay the same cash rent that they would on surrounding land. And then what they've got is a cropping history, and they're more likely to qualify for loans to start their own businesses, to buy their own farms.
We've been throwing around the term organic certified and organic. So, Kathleen, can you help us shed a little bit of light? What is the difference between organic certified and what might also be considered to be organic?
Okay, well, you can't officially use the term organic unless you are certified organic.
Okay.
So, you know, privately people can say, I'm organic, but if they put it on their label anywhere or sell it to anyone and say it's organic, it must be certified organic. So it must go through a third party, an independent third party, to verify that all the practices are organic. I'll just take, for example, the state of Iowa, IDOL's organic certification program, which certifies our organic farm in Iowa State. And they come out for an annual inspection, and you have to keep all records of any inputs you use. So I'm glad you brought up manure, because that's our main fertilizer source for our crops. And manure can come from non-organic or conventional farms. It just has to be composted properly or put on 4 months ahead of vegetable harvest, 3 months ahead of grain harvest, which we always put it on in the spring, so it's never a problem. And they'll look at all your records for if you use any pest management, everything has to be organic compliant. And then your harvest operation has to be segregated from any conventional harvest on the farm. The normal inspection takes about 3 hours. It depends how big your farm is, but probably for the average organic farm in Iowa, it's about a three-hour inspection. And, of course, there's fees that go with that, but that way it gives the consumer confidence that everything does follow the USDA National Organic Program rules.
And why would somebody who is practicing organic methods not go through that certification process?
Well, I'll just take, for example, a small CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Farm I know. They do use 100% organic practices, but they know all their customers. They have a small customer base. So they feel like they can just tell their customers what they use, and the customers trust them. If you're selling to a wholesale market, selling to Hy-Vee, for example, they will require a certificate because they can't go out and inspect your farm themselves. They don't know you personally. So anyone that's doing larger sales would benefit from being certified.
What would the cost be in that certification process?
So I can just speak for ours at Iowa State. What we pay when we do average inspection is about $300
per
year. And I don't know, Linda, do you know your cost there at the Marshalltown Farm?
You know, I don't. It's not my gig. Our farm manager does that, so I don't know that right now.
So for a very small farm, if it's not a big deal to them, they might just not want to jump through that hoop. But it's not cost prohibitive.
No, I don't think so. I mean, you should be able to reap or, you know, gain the benefit back from increased markup on your sales, premium prices, they call it.
All right.
Organic.
And I want to talk more about the definitions of organic and definitions of sustainable agriculture. We're going to have to do that in just a few minutes because I think if we dive into that subject, we'll run out of time pretty quickly. We are talking about organic agriculture in the lead up to the 10th Annual Organic Conference at Iowa State University, which is coming up in 3 weeks. I'm talking with Kathleen Dellett, who's a professor of agronomy and horticulture and extension organic specialist at Iowa State. And I'm also talking with Linda Barnes, who's the coordinator of the Sustainable and Entrepreneurial Agriculture Program at Marshalltown Community College. We'll talk more about the transition to organic in a moment. And if you have any questions, please feel free to join our conversation. The number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you have transitioned your farm from conventional to organic, we would love to hear from you. Again, that number is 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guests right now are Kathleen Dellett. She's a professor of agronomy and horticulture and extension organic specialist at Iowa State University. And also Linda Barnes, who's coordinator of the Sustainable and Entrepreneurial Agriculture Program, also a biology professor at Marshalltown Community College. And today we are talking about organic agriculture, the growth in the movement in Iowa in the lead up to the 10th Annual Organic Conference at Iowa State, which is November 21st. And 22nd. You are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Kathleen, one of the terms that gets thrown around in this conversation is also sustainable agriculture. Can you tell me, I know there are many definitions for it, but can you give me an idea of what is the difference between someone who practices sustainability and someone who does organic farming?
Well, I'll attempt to. In the big picture, we feel like all practices that organic farmers use meet sustainable agriculture definitions. And it's using practices with a focus to the future, i.e. the word sustainable, that the practices you'll use on your farm that will help sustain it for many generations to come. And that to us implies that you're going to be using as few or no fossil fuels. So inorganic fossil fuel-based inputs are completely prohibited, i.e. no synthetic fertilizers, no synthetic pesticides.
Although you can use a tractor.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Definitely you can use the oil to run the tractor, but it doesn't go onto the plant.
Right.
It's not absorbed by the plants. And then while unsustainable, they do use fossil fuel-based inputs. So I don't really know how they define that exactly.
Okay. We have Steve on the line from Kelowna with a question. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Hi. What was your question today?
My question is if you go through the whole organic certification process and then your neighbor is having his field sprayed and through drift you then put pesticides, herbicides, synthetic fertilizers on your fields, I understand that then there's a 3-year process of waiting before you can be certified organic again. And I know several farmers that this has happened to where you can literally be put out of business in a breeze. Is anything being done to change that or make it so that it's not going to impact organic farmers what their neighbors are doing and drifting onto their fields?
Kathleen, well, can you respond?
Yeah, sure. Let me first say that it is illegal against the law to drift on anyone's property. So the very first thing you should do is report them to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. They have a whole program that deals with this. Pesticide drift. In the 12 years I've been at Iowa State, I've probably dealt with 7 drift cases. In every case, the organic farmer, of course, won because they were drifted on, and the person who drifted on them had to pay damages. So, you know, no one should tolerate this. It's against the law. It's against the law for anyone, conventional or organic. You can't drift on anybody. You can't drift chemicals on anybody's property. Number two, it's case specific. In other words, IDLs will come out and do a very thorough investigation, and if it turns out that it is a product that has a short life and there's scientific evidence that it won't damage the crop for next season, you can go back into organic certification the next year. If it's a persistent chemical that they drifted on your farm, then it may take 2 or 3 years, but it's you know, I just want to make it clear that the organic farmer always has remedies and recourse and should pursue to the extent possible, the largest extent possible.
So when they pursue, what is the first step that they would need to take?
Right, call IDOL's Pesticide Division in Des Moines.
And I might add that you want to do this as soon as possible. For example, if your clothing were sprayed, you need to save that clothing and not wash it. And make these contacts so that samples can be taken if there's some disagreement before it's washed away.
Good point.
Okay. Thank you so much for your call, Steve. And Spence is on the line from Davenport. Hello, Spence.
Yes. I have 2 questions. One, what's the record of profitability for organic farming versus conventional? And the other is, what are you doing to replace the elements that are taken off the property and sold in your products?
Okay, so the second question is about fertilizer.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. We'll take those one at a time. Thanks a lot, Spence. So first, profitability. What's in it for the farmer?
Right, yeah. We've been conducting an economic analysis with Dr. Craig Chase from ISU for the 12 years we've been doing organic research at Iowa State. And while it's been dipping up and down, depending on the market, I would say the average overall has been 2 to 3 times higher returns with the organic system compared to the conventional. And all that information is available online. If you go into Iowa State webpage and type in organic budgets, and it will bring up Dr. Chase's work. And, for example, right now, I think organic corn is going for $6 a bushel and organic soybeans about $17 a bushel. And that's compared to $5, $6 for a conventional. So on average, it's been about twice as much, we found out. And then the second question.
And I do need to mention that in about 10 minutes, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about manure. So
oh,
we'll spend a little bit
my
of time talking
subject.
About manure right now. But and manure is the fertilizer of choice in organics.
It is, and it can be dealt with several ways. I mean, it can be applied directly to the soil. A lot of farmers do that. A lot compost it. They'll mix it with a carbon source like hay or straw. Wood chips are the least preferable because they take so long to break down. But making your own compost is very popular, especially more so in the vegetable growing regions in California. In Iowa, I'd say maybe 10% of the organic farmers actually compost it. They usually just put it on as raw manure in the fall or in the early spring, mix it in with the soil very well. If you need any pest management inputs, the main way to prevent pests or the main way to deal with pests is through prevention using tolerant or resistant varieties. For example, there's a new soybean aphid resistant variety we can use now for organic soybeans. And but if you do need to use spray something, if none of the preventive tactics work, you can. There are some organic compliant sprays that are made from natural products like neem from the neem tree that can be used against insect pests. So just about every input that you have in conventional, there is a counterpart in organic.
Okay, Spence, thank you so much for your question. Linda, what do you teach your students about fertilizing the land?
We talk a lot about manure and composting as well, and we also talk about the use of cover crops, which can be grown in off seasons. Or alternately with your cash crops, which will improve the soil. And we talk about something called a green manure, which isn't manure at all, but a crop that's grown and then tilled into the soil to improve the quality of the soil and improve the nutrients available. And we also talk about how the healthier a plant is, sort of like how healthy we are, the less vulnerable it is to insect damage and to disease. So the more available nutrients and the healthier the soil, the more likely your plants are to be able to sustain mild injury from insects and to resist disease, which is something you can see in your own garden. If you've got healthy soil, your plants tend to do much better and to resist those sorts of problems.
Kathleen, you mentioned putting manure on in the fall and mixing it well with the soil, which sounds like you would need to do fall tilling, which is not a sustainable method. How do you get past the erosion problems if you try to use that method?
Right, yeah. I'm glad you picked that up, Charity, because we don't advocate that at Iowa State. I'm just saying I have seen farmers do that because they fear they won't be able to get in the spring, and we have had very wet springs. We're always on edge if we're going to be able to get out there and work the soil in the spring. So a lot of farmers do it as a fail-safe tactic, but in fact we don't do it at our research plots. We wait till spring to till the manure in.
Okay, and Linda, with composted manure, how would you apply that to a field?
You could apply it in the same way you would apply manure with a manure spreader.
Okay, and then you would apply it first and then till the field?
And then you can plant.
All right.
And Linda brought up a good thing, too, that just this year some folks were reporting problems with a disease called sudden death syndrome in soybeans, and they were noticing that it wasn't as prevalent or non-existent in fields that had a longer rotation, i.e. weren't just corn and soybean, but had corn, soybean, oats in the rotation. And I have to say, in our organic fields across the state, we didn't see any evidence of sudden death this year. And we do practice three-year rotation or four-year rotation. So I think there definitely is something there as far as having diversity in the soil to help prevent disease.
Jean is on the line from Shellsburg. Hello, Jean.
Hi, Kathleen. It's Gene. How you doing?
Good. Great to hear from you, Gene.
You answered my question a little bit earlier. I was wanting to get a hold of some of that statistical analysis on the comparison of organic to conventional, because I've been trying to get a hold of that for a long time, and I can't find it on the website. But I wrote down where to do it, so I'll look again for that. But I just wanted to give you a kudos. I've known Kathleen ever since she started working at Iowa State in the organic department, and what she's done there, and her progress on the the research farm. I even helped her with some of the projects. She's just done a great job, and I think anybody who's interested in organic agriculture should really attend the conference, because they have everything from the beginner to the hardcore organic farmer. There's something there for everybody, and the speakers that she's having are fantastic. So I just wanted to put that good plug in for you, Kathleen.
And all right.
I wanted to let you know we did get our product into Whole Foods, so we may be going national with Whole Foods with our popcorn. So,
well, congratulations! Gene. Thanks a lot for your call, Gene. And next up, we have Mark on the line in East Moline. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. A question I had, or actually, I have two small ones. What is your seed stock? Are you using GM seeds? Are you using any special varieties? Are there heirloom local producers that are doing this organically, et cetera? And the second one I had is, when you mention corn and soybeans, I think of the mass market and thousands of acres. What is the market for that, and why would anybody want, and I'm not saying it's wrong, I'm just saying why would anybody want organic soybeans as an example? Is that a food product then?
Okay, mm-hmm. Well, let's start with the first question, which is about seed stocks. And of course, many genetically modified seeds are out there, and there is some controversy about that. Can you grow organic if you have genetically modified seeds?
No, I'm sorry. I missed saying that right up front. I should have said that up front. Transgenic crops, as they're known, are not allowed in organic production. So, you wouldn't have any GMO, Roundup Ready, or any of those types of crops on your organic farms. And you do need a separation between you and your neighbor if they're growing any genetically modified crops.
What would qualify as a separation?
Well, the minimum is 30 feet, but sometimes that's not enough. You need to make sure you talk to your neighbor. And in general, organic farms plant later than conventional. So they usually miss what's called the pollination nick, to avoid any contamination in the field. So there are several practices that you can employ to avoid that the potential for contamination.
Okay, and probably a tree line would probably
exactly
help as well. Okay,
definitely having that windbreak there would definitely help. So we rely on conventionally bred genetics, and the organic seed industry has grown leaps and bounds since I've been here. For example, there's a company in Kelly, Iowa called Blue River that has organic hybrids now, and they use the same process as any conventional hybrids and have some really good products. There's a lot of companies out there now. We'll have a lot displaying at the Iowa Organic Conference, too. So the genetics are really improving for organic seed. It was a lot more difficult when I first started 12 years ago.
Well, and let's talk about the more conventional crops, corn and soybeans. Mm-hmm. What kind of market is there for organic soybeans and or maybe organic corn as well?
Right. The market's huge. We can't supply enough. We're still getting product from overseas to meet the demand for organic foods. And yes, primarily the soybeans are going into organic food, i.e. tofu, soy milk, things like that. But they're also being used in livestock feed. Poultry, for example, is a big organic poultry is a big consumer of organic soybeans. Corn, in Iowa, primarily the corn market is for livestock feed. But there are people, I know Linda's growing, they're growing organic white corn for tortillas.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a big market for organic food-grade corn, too. And Gene Mealhill just talked about his, and I didn't pay him to call in on about the poplars either, but he has fabulous K&K organic popcorn corn. If you ever see it, try it out. And that's all grown organically, too.
Linda, a caller had a question for you, and they had to drop off the line, but they were wondering if there is any problem that organic farmers have in getting their agriculture exemptions. They said that they had heard that people in Linn County who were trying to grow organically were having trouble getting their agricultural exemptions. Have you had any experience with that?
Most of my students have gone on to, they're more inclined to raise alternative crops, so I don't have those statistics. They tend to be in areas that aren't used for conventional crops. So, for example, I have a student who has a vineyard. Another one raises chickens for eggs and vegetables for farmers markets. So they have a different focus than the more conventional crops.
Okay, and so when talking about agricultural exemptions, I'm sure we're talking, or not necessarily exemptions, but the tax breaks that agricultural land get. Have you had any issue with that?
Not that I'm aware of, not that my students have told me about. Again, they're kind of off the grid because they tend to be smaller, and they don't have this. They have it's a different set of issues than the farmers that have larger farms.
Okay, we have just one moment left, and I want to ask each of you in 30 seconds or less, what do you see as the future of organic in Iowa? And Linda, you can go first.
Well, I have to say again that our focus is not just organic. That's just one part of what we're doing. I think what we view as the future of organics and alternative agriculture is to increase the food that we eat locally, because we eat more than 85% of our food from outside the state. So I think we need to improve the sustainability of our economy, the sustainability of our communities, the sustainability of our farmers. And I think that's what we're focusing on. And I think there's a future for that in Iowa, to eat better and to have more rural enterprises.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for your time today. Linda Barnes is the coordinator of the Sustainable and Entrepreneurial Agriculture Program at Marshalltown Community College. Kathleen Dellett is a professor of agronomy and horticulture and extension organic specialist at Iowa State University. And the 10th annual Iowa Organic Conference is coming up at Iowa State University on November 21st and 22nd. You can find out more about that on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and there are a lot of words for manure. Poop is pretty popular. Excrement works. My next guest uses his favorite word for it, and if we used that word, that would earn us an FCC fine. It also caused a little bit of consternation in our household last night when my five-year-old decided to sound out the title of the book I was reading. Mama, is that sit? She said. So for the purposes of today's show, I'm going to tell you that Gene Logsdon farms in Upper Sandusky, Ohio, and his latest book is called Holy Poop, Managing Manure to Save Mankind. Hello, Gene.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here.
Your introduction to that is the most original one yet.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. So, Gene, manure was once, of course, the most used fertilizer in agriculture. You believe that it should be and probably will be again. Why did using manure fall out of favor on a lot of farms?
Oh, it's botheration, just like everything else. Why did we quit using privies and went to bathrooms? You know, it's I'd say the main reason is just utility, one reason. It does take a little more work to use manure than it does to call up the local fertilizer supplier and have them come out and spread some powder on. But I think it's also a cultural thing that it just seems to me, just like this whole business here about not being able to say the title of the book and everything, we're ashamed of our excrement. We're afraid of it almost, and it's like a cultural thing. We scrubbed the most common word for it in the English language, or at least in the American language, from polite conversation. And behind this seems to me is reluctance to admit that we do have waste. You know, if we eat something, some of it's got to come out the other end, to be crude about it. And so we have conveniently in our society, mostly because commercial fertilizer used to be so cheap, we've conveniently sort of made our minds stop fronting up to the fact that excrement is all about life. And so it was easy enough then. Farm Journal magazine back in, I think it was 1961, had an article in which they said manure wasn't worth hauling. And so even farmers, decided that this would be the case to the magazine's to their good to their goodness, their good hearts, they, just a few years later, they ran another article in which they said, yes, it is worthwhile.
So you in your book, you sort of make a joking prediction that manure is going to be one of the hottest commodity on the Chicago Board of Trade one of these days. Why do you believe that?
Because the sources of commercial fertilizer are in decline. You know, we get most of our potash from Canada, from mines in Canada, and they're on the decline. Natural gas is how we get almost all of our nitrogen fertilizer now in commercial farming. And the uses for natural gas, of course, there's so many competing uses that it means that the price of it is of nitrogen fertilizer is bound to rise. And phosphorus fertilizers are really the ones that are the most, I think, rising the most right now. And we're just running out of easy sources. You know, this stuff will always be around someplace to get, but it won't be cheap. And so every time the price of commercial fertilizer goes up, the value of manure goes up. You know, I had one of my dear friends, well, he's also my cousin, you know, he farms very many acres, like 6,000 or 8,000. And I got this in the book, you know, he called the other day and he said he's going to start a beef lot, a cattle lot, and to feed out beef. And I said, well, you know, in this part of the country, you know as well as I do, it's not very much money in it, except as a kind of a tax dodge. And he said, I don't care if it just breaks even. He said, I need the manure. He said, it costs me $600 an acre now to grow corn, you know, and, of course, about $100 of that is manure. And on 8,000 acres, that mounts up to a lot of money. So that's why I think it's going to be. And, in fact, it's already started. The large-scale chicken poultry houses and feedlots and dairies, they're now, especially poultry, they're drying their manure and getting it in a material that doesn't stink so terribly bad, and farmers are lining up to get it, paying for it. Whereas just 5 years ago, these chicken
factories couldn't give it away.
Couldn't give it away. Yep.
The large scale cattle and beef and pork operations here in Iowa still, you know, have the large manure lagoons. We still have problems with spills. There have been 13 manure spills this month so far from some of these. I mean, you know, the smaller spills, some of them, but, you know, still.
I thought they had solved that problem. Yes, that's interesting.
But this rise in the value of manure could solve that problem for us.
Oh, yes. And it definitely will, I think, yeah. Well, you hate to be prophet. the world will make a fool out of you every time you try to predict the future. So, but
well, in your book, you describe a lot of the methods that farmers used to use to handle their manure and use it as fertilizer. And it strikes me that this is instructive for people who want to get back to that. And you write a lot about the manure pack. How do you manage manure in either a poultry operation or a cattle operation by using this manure pack method?
Well, with poultry and with hogs, as organic farmers are doing now, they refer to it as deep litter. And what they really do is where the animals are kept, they put in very generous supplies of bedding. Straw is the best, but corn stalks work pretty well too. And then the animals are constantly manuring into this, trampling it down at the same time. And over a year's period, you know, that gets to be quite a thick manure pack, we call it. But it's really there for is called deep litter. And the same way with chickens, it doesn't really pack so much. You know, the hogs will root it up, so it doesn't get down to a firm pack. The chickens will scratch it up, so it stays more as a loose litter. And if you do it correctly, you needn't clean your chicken coop or your hog pen out, but once a year, because you just let it build up, and the more that builds up, the more it will soak the urine too into it. It's really actually becoming quite practical for mid-sized farmers to adopt. Of course, you know, when I first started the book, I was thinking about all the people who are getting into local food or their own backyard food, and they want to go beyond gardens and have animals, raise some of their own meat, and they just knew nothing at all. They just, and I don't mean that as a derogatory way, but they're totally ignorant about manure. And so I just started out just to talk to those people, and then when I got into it, I found out that organic farmers were really progressed farther than I had, and they were going back to the deep litter system or the manure pack. Now, the manure pack that I think of, because I used to milk cows, so I know a lot about that, and here we now, instead of keeping cows in regular dairy stanchion barns, we now let them go at what we call loafing sheds. You know, they're not loafing for the farmer, I can tell you that. But when you milk the cows, you take them into the parlor, as they call it. And anyway, but most of the day, if they're not out grazing, the cows are in this large, very large loafing shed. And where they excrete and urinate, and you put down fresh straw every day, and that builds up, and it ages anaerobically. Whereas, you know, in garden composting, you let it heat up, you know, in small little compost bins. But here in a commercial farm operation, you it's more anaerobic. And after about a year, it takes a – in fact, you don't want it to heat up because that loses nitrogen. And so as the cows trample it and it builds up, you really need to only haul the manure out about once a year. That's the way it works.
You mentioned losing nitrogen, and that's one of your concerns with the management of manure, is that certain management methods, you do lose a lot of the important elements of manure. How do you preserve that?
Well, the reason I'm stuttering is because backyarders in their compost bins, they like, you know, it's all about heating it up so that it degrades quickly. But that's losing manure. It doesn't matter so much to a it's losing nitrogen. That doesn't matter so much to a gardener because he's got a small amount and he usually has large amounts of compost to put on a small amount of garden. But on a farm, you want to stretch that manure out as economically as you can over as many acres as you can. And so you do not want it to heat up. And if it degrades slowly over a year's time, then the heat, you know, of a compost pile is really the leaching of nitrogen or out into the air. And so all that heat means you're losing value. So if the manure is worth... Well, I say it's worth about $100 an acre to apply, and it loses the nitrogen, especially nitrogen, then it's losing its value. And
so in your book, you're a proponent of not just using animal waste or the animal waste that we typically think of. You're a proponent of not just using cow manure, horse manure, and poultry manure, but you also are a proponent of using other kinds of manure that most people steer very clear of. How do you see, and well, let's start with dog and cat waste. How do you see our domestic animals that we keep within our homes? How do you see that working into this?
Well, there's 73 million pet cats out there and 68 million pet dogs, and that's a lot of manure. And, of course, now what usually happens is the cats especially, they have litter boxes, and then you bag up the litter in plastic bags and put it and send it off to the
landfill.
Landfill, thank you. And so it could just as easily be put in a compost pile. Now, there's still a lot of thought, and even at the university level, that cat manure and dog manure are too dangerous to put into.
I have certainly heard that.
Well, it's just like everything else, if it's poorly handled, that's a possibility. But actually, in a compost pile or even just in a pile where it's allowed to age for a year, almost all those pathogens are gone. You know, and say almost, okay, but enough of them are gone so that it's safe to use on your garden, very safe. And this message is only slowly getting out. There's lots of books written specifically on that. You know, the Humanor Handbook, you know that one? It goes on and on about how safe pet manures can be handled correctly.
Well, and the title of that indicates something else that you talked about, which is human manure, which you also believe can be used safely.
Oh, yes. That's the most controversial of all, as I'm sure you know. And even, you know, most organic certification will not allow human manure. But here again, the problem is not the human manure. It's the stuff that people are, what we're flushing down the toilet, you know, old pills and antibiotics and hormone medicines. And these are what will cause the problems. And there again, it becomes an insurmountable problem. How do you, you know, legislate, regulate everybody in their bathroom not to do this? But as a matter of fact, where human manure is treated properly, it can be a very safe fertilizer. You know, and this has been stated on the highest scientific levels. But so far, organic farmers are not allowed to use it if you're certified in most cases. Now, we've been spreading, I'm sure it's true of every place else, but I know here in northwestern Ohio, we've been spreading human manure, sludge, you know, biosolids, mm-hmm. I like to use that word because it's more positive, for over a century on farmland. And as far as I've been able to find, no case of disease has been directly traced to that.
Well, Gene, we have just a minute left, and the title of your book does imply that this is bigger picture for you than just making sure that farmers are growing healthy crops. Managing manure to save mankind, why do you think this is so vital to our society?
What are we going to do with all this waste? You know, you're going to have to deal with it one way or another. And here we have a way to do it where it's profitable, you know. Make this stuff, treat this stuff to the point where you can use it on farmland. If we run out of fertilizer and we don't have, you know, commercial fertilizer, and we don't have anything to take their place, this world would be in a sad place. You know, that's why I say manure is holy.
And you also think that we need to manage all the other kinds of waste, not just as fertilizer, but we need to manage it better for our society, our human waste. What problem do you think we need to fix?
On human waste?
Right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we have to teach people that there are ways. There's a new thing out right now, I don't know if it's a discovery, but they are finding a way to, out of sludge, you know, out of human waste, gone through the treatment plants, they found a way now that they can extract the phosphorus from it to use as fertilizer. So see, this solves then the problem for everybody who thinks that manure is dangerous, because here they're just going to extract the phosphorus out of it, and then I don't know what they're going to do with the rest of it, but at least we will be starting to use our own waste for a good purpose.
Well, Gene, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Gene Logsdon is the author of a book that, again, I'll call Holy Poop, Managing Manure to Save Mankind. You can find out everything you need to know about managing manure for your farm and for our society. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation with Sarah Vowell.